light dwells with Him. To You, O God, and my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we ask of You, for You have made known to us the king's matter. Later on in verse 47 of this same chapter, the Bible would record, the king answered and said to Daniel, truly your God is God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, for You have been able to reveal this mystery. Later in chapter 4, verse 17, the sentence is that by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will and sets over it the lowliest of men. And finally, chapter 5, verse 21, Daniel would record in that chapter, he was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He's fed grass, various things happened, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets it over whom He will. What we need to understand as we begin the study of sovereignty is that the basic idea is that God is in control of the overall world. Now we understand that this is balanced with man's individual freedom of choice, and that God does not condone, and it is not God's will that such evil and heinous acts happen. But many times we understand that God, in His foreknowledge and in His sovereignty, knows that many evil acts will happen, and He allows those things and uses those things in a way that brings about His greater will for all of humanity. And as the book of Daniel is thinking, and as I think we should be more cautious to think about, we're thinking about, in a broader sense, the entire world. For example, Romans 8:28, we know that all things work for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Now, I think that applies to us individually, but I think the overall message is that God causes all things in this world to work for His greater good and glory. And that's what Daniel is saying too, is that God is in control of the history of the world. He's in control of this world. And that even though it may look like, and we've seen various pagan empires rise and even persecute Christians awfully, it is still the case that God is sovereign and God is in charge, and He brings about His ultimate will and will bring about His ultimate will. What I want to do is look at the six storytelling chapters of Daniel, the first six chapters. The latter seven and following get into a lot of prophecy and difficult things. But I want to look at the first six chapters, and I want to make a point from each of those chapters about God's sovereignty and about our life and some principles that apply to our life. The first thing is, as we think about, this is the point, God rules in the kingdom of men. And chapter 1 is God rules over the wisdom of men. In chapter 1, and I hope you have your Bibles open to the book of Daniel, as we're going to be just going through this great book. In Daniel chapter 1, the men of Judah and some of the best of Judah have been taken captivity by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, when he besieged Jerusalem. And you remember, he takes the brightest and the best. And in verse 6, we hear about how he has taken Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And he gives these men pagan names, which represent the gods of the Babylonians. And then he sets them up in what we might consider a tutoring or mentoring program and education, where they're going to be educated in all the ways of the Babylonians or Chaldeans. They're going to be set under the charge of the eunuch, who has the responsibility of making sure these men have everything available to them. And we might think about it today is that these guys were picked for their intelligence, and they're going to get the highest university education you can get. And they've got this great scholarship program. But a part of that program was that they were going to be allowed to eat food that came from the king's table. And we're not told exactly the details of this, but it seems that this involved two concepts. At least one of these two concepts is probably right. Number one, it might have been food that had been offered to idols, and so it had that idolatrous tone to it, and they could not participate because it had that. Or it might have been the concept that it was saying there, the king, they were loyal to the king, and they were trusting in the king more than God. For whatever reason, these men could not eat this food and wine that was offered from the king's table. And Daniel resolved in his heart that he would not defile himself, verse number 8, with the king's food and with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Well, this risked the chief of the eunuchs' life even. But because Daniel had favor with him, he had compassion on him, and they set up a test where they went for 10 days. They didn't have to eat the king's food. They could eat vegetables and water, it says. And by the way, I don't think there's, you know, some have tried to get a Daniel's diet out of this, and some people today have tried to use this in different ways. I really don't think the intention here is to talk about the kind of diet we should be eating. I think this, the issue here is that they are going to be healthier, they're going to be wiser, and the text and the emphasis is not because of the food, but it is because of God. It is because of God. Notice verse 16 and following. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. And as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And when the king spoke to these four men, and they stood before the king, in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his kingdom. What's the point? Brethren, we live in a world today where there's a big emphasis on the wisdom of the world. And in fact, we as conservative Christians are sometimes ridiculed for beliefs that we hold. Things like we believe that God created Adam and Eve and that all humanity has come from the descendants of Adam and Eve. That we believe in a global flood and that all descendants have come from the descendants of Noah and his wife and his 3 sons. We believe that every person is going to be held on account in judgment one day before God. And that every person therefore has a soul. And that they are not just a body, but they are also a spirit and soul. And the wisdom of the world often says, in a secular, humanistic, evolutionary perspective, right opposite of those things. And we are often made to feel ridiculed, ignorant, and small because of the beliefs we have. And what I want you to know is that in this same kind of situation that Daniel and his friends were in, when we stand up and when we trust in God and we keep our commitments and our convictions strong in God, ultimately, we understand that God rules. His sovereignty, His will is going to bless and approve and bless those who stand strong in Him. God rules over the wisdom of men. You know, we don't need to fear science. We don't need to fear archaeological discoveries. We don't need to fear ancient discoveries. That they're going to, you know, come up with things that will destroy our faith. We can trust that we have God's Word and God rules over the wisdom of men. But look at chapter 2. Chapter 2 is a long chapter that deals with, most of y'all probably heard this story, and if you haven't heard it, let me encourage you to really to read this entire book of Daniel, first 6 chapters, as you think about these stories. But this story is the one that involves Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And Nebuchadnezzar has a dream where he dreams about this statue. And the statue has the head of gold, the arms of silver, and the waist of bronze, and the legs of iron. And he is troubled by this, and a great stone smashes into the feet of the dream and shatters it. And he is confused. And he is going to kill all of the magicians and wise men of his country. That means that Daniel and his three friends would be killed. But Daniel goes and pleads and says, "Give me some time, let me pray, and the God of heaven can reveal this dream to you." And so the story continues on that Daniel is going to reveal this dream and will tell him the answer to this dream. And so this picks up in verse 31. So Daniel will interpret this dream, and he says, "O king, behold a great image. This image, mighty and exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening." The king would not tell him what the dream was. That was part of the thing. They had to tell him what the dream was. So Daniel tells him what the dream was, and about this image with the head of gold, the arms of silver, the thighs of bronze, and the legs of iron. And he continues on through this story. And he tells him in verses 36 and following that he is the head of gold. And each of these different metals represent a future kingdom that will be to come. The arms of silver represent the Medo-Persian Empire, which will come. The bronze empire is the Persian Empire that will follow. And then you have the Greek Empire. And finally, the iron legs are the Roman Empire. And you have forecast here the next 800 years of history. And so he prophesies and tells him these things. And then look at verse number 44, because that's an important verse. Talking about in the days of the iron kings, that's the days of the Roman kings. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. But it shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring to an end, and it shall stand forever. This is a prophecy, as understood by the New Testament, of the eternal kingdom, the church. And notice, as you understand this basic history, when did Jesus come? When was the church established? During the days of the Roman kings. Jesus was born during that time period, and the church is established during that time period. Now, it's not our purpose tonight to really study out chapter 2. That's a whole other sermon. And look at all these kingdoms and things. But here's the point I want you to get. God is sovereign over the future. We need to hear that message. You know, we can get worried about the future. We can wonder and fear about what is forecast politically. And when we think about all the nations out there, and we think about the tension between North Korea and America, between Russia and America, and we can talk about the nation of China and its policies and how fast it is growing and its size, or India and the number of people they have. And we can think about all these different political situations that are going on that we fear. And I tell you, there's some legitimate concerns there, and I certainly think we should pray about those things. But church, we got to come back to, God is in control. God is in control. Now, you may have a lot of questions, and you say, "Josh, but what about this? Josh, what about this?" And I'll tell you, I don't know probably what about that. But I do know this. God rules over the future. Daniel can make this prophecy detailing out the next 600-700 years about all these future kingdoms that were going to come, and it came about exactly as he prophesied. God rules in the kingdoms of men over the future. But number three, And our kids know this one, right? Chapter 3 is a great story about those three men who we do not know by their Hebrew names. It's interesting. You know, chapter 1 tells us their Hebrew names and then their Babylonian names. And we know Daniel by his Hebrew name, but the other three men we know as their Babylonian names. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it is chapter 3 that tells their story. And I don't know why or where Daniel is. Commentators think that he, who had escalated to a higher level of position, might have been in another part of the nation ruling as a governor. We're not told where Daniel is. But we do know that these three men are commanded to come, and when the musical instruments are sounded, they are to bow down at this ginormous statue that Nebuchadnezzar has made, either unto himself as a god or to a pagan god. We're not really for sure. He makes it, and he says, when the music plays, you've got to bow down to this image and worship. And of course, the Hebrew guys, they could not do that. They would violate their conscience. They would be sinning against God. That goes against the first and second of the Ten Commandments. You cannot have a graven image, and you cannot worship or bow down before any other gods. And so they can't do it. And of course, they are told that if they do not do it, what's going to happen? Thrown into a fiery furnace. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to make one of the great statements in the Bible when they're going to speak about their thoughts about this. So let's look at this passage and read a little bit of it. So they're told about this, and notice verse number 9. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man, so they're talking about this decree that they got to do it, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the burning fiery furnace. And they tell on these three Jews. And then verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar is furious and rage against this. And he has these three men brought in. And he tells them they've got one more chance to bow down and worship. In verse number 15, if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace. And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said, verse number 16, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. But if this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. They said, we don't know how this is going to turn out. We might die. We don't know if God's going to spare us. He can. He has the power to do it. But whether He does or not, we're not going to worship the golden image. And I think that's a great illustration of God's sovereignty. We don't know if God will always choose to deliver us. We know He has the power to deliver us. But we don't know what He's going to do. But we pray and we trust, and the main thing we do is live in faith. We live in a life of conviction. They said, I don't know what's God going to do, but I know one thing. We're not bowing down. You can throw us in that furnace, you can burn us up, but we're not bowing down. What an example of faith. One of the great stories in the Old Testament. Of course, the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey says, is that he does throw them into that fiery furnace, but they are not destroyed. Their clothes are not even singed. There is another man walking in the fiery furnace with them, which was either an angel or may have been a pre-incarnate Christ. Some think that that was Christ who came and was with them in the fiery furnace. And so the point is, God rules over trials of fire. God rules over trials of fire. I know there are some of you here tonight who are going through some fiery trials. And I want you to remember that you don't know how it's going to turn out. God has the power. He has the power to deliver. But your job is to trust and to keep obeying.
to not bow down to any pagan images, to keep the faith. And God is sovereign. He is the one who's in charge. And ultimately, whatever that ultimately means for your situation, you will have God's peace and God's comfort and God's ruling in that situation. God rules over trials of fire. But number four, chapter four, this is an interesting one. This is the story of Nebuchadnezzar having another dream. And this is a dream about a great big tree. And in this story, in this dream, Nebuchadnezzar is going to be warned by Daniel about this big tree and this great vision. So let's read some of the interpretation of this dream. Let's drop down to verse number 20. Daniel chapter 4, verse 20. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong, so that its top reached in the heaven, it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and which was food for all. And all the beasts of the field came underneath this, and the birds of the heavens lived. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reached the heavens. So he's like a great big tree. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, this is a pretty good illustration for pride, isn't it? Chop down the tree and destroy it. We still use that analogy. We say that guy needs to have his knees chopped down a little bit. He needs to be cut down, I guess is the expression I'm looking for. He needs to be cut down a little bit. What we mean is, he needs to be humbled. He needs to be humbled. And so, he is made to become a beast of the field. And he has the dew of heaven soak him. And his portion is with the beast of the field till seven periods of time pass over. And that's exactly what happened after he forgot that. Down in verse number 25, you should be made to eat grass like an ox. You should be wet with the dew of heaven till seven periods of time pass over, and till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom He wills. But God commanded to leave the stump, and he would rise again out of that stump. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is told, don't forget that God is in charge. He goes for 12 months. He doesn't forget it. The dream doesn't come true. And then after 12 months, he is in his palace. And verse 25, the king answered and said, is not this the great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? And while the words were still in the king's mouth, they fell a voice from heaven. And that voice is going to make him be driven out, and he's going to live like a beast for seven periods of time. Don't really know what that means. That could be 7 years. That could be a seven figurative till it was completed. It could be 7 months. Whatever it was a long period of time for him to grow long fingernails, to have his hair grow out, to have all these things happen to him. God rules over pride-filled leaders. Over pride-filled leaders. You know, the message for us today and for all leaders in the church, in the business world, in the political world, is that we must remember from where our strength comes from. We need to remember that God is in control. And He rules, therefore, He will humble arrogant leaders. I think about Acts chapter 12, where Herod is given a speech there, and they claim, the people do, a voice of not a man, but a voice of God. And he said, yeah, that's right, I'm a voice of God. And God sent worms, intestinal worms, and he died a horrific death. God rules over pride-filled leaders. We trust that. We believe that. Number five is the story of them drinking and having this wild party using the emblems taken from the temple of God and a hand with a finger, like a human hand, begins to write on the walls.
and it writes a message, and Daniel has to come interpret that message, and it is the message that you have been weighed, your kingdom has been weighed, and you have been found wanting. You have been found in trouble. And that is, you're going to lose your kingdom tonight. And that the hand had written, verse 25, the phrase, mene, mene, tike, parson, which involves this idea of balances and weights. And it is the idea that you have been judged and you're found wanting. And that very night, verse 30, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and then the Medes will take over as the kingdom. God rules over wicked nations. God destroys and rises up nations as He chooses. There's a warning in there for America, isn't there? Proverbs 14:34, righteousness exalts a nation, but a sin is a reproach to any people. And finally, chapter 6 is the story of Daniel and the lion's den. You're familiar with that story. Daniel is an aged man now, and he is a man who prayed 3 times a day. His enemies were jealous of him. They wanted to destroy him. They could not get to him in any way except through his faith. So they had a law written. If you pray to any other god for the next 30 days besides the king, then you had to be thrown to the lions. And so Daniel did what Daniel did. He did as his custom was. He goes, verse number 10 and following, to his open window in his upper chamber, knelt toward Jerusalem, and he prayed, just as he always had. And of course, they will throw him to the lions. King Darius is very upset about this, but there's nothing he can do about this because he had signed it. And of course, Daniel is not eaten by the lions, but the lions do not destroy him. And the point I want us to see from that is that God rules over His creation. When you think about this story, it is that God, of course, stops the mouths of the lions, that He controls them and makes them not eat Daniel. But of course, that goes all throughout the Bible, that God is the master over this world in its creation. For example, Jesus is going to calm the water. He's going to bring people back from the dead. He's going to multiply the fish. He's going to create great hauls of fish. Jesus does a lot of things with nature and things that were supernatural or miracles. God rules over His creation. And so as you think about those 6 things from the book of Daniel, which has as its primary message, God is ruling. Now, as we conclude, I want to take you back to the book of Daniel. And I want you to realize that Daniel was written to people who were in Babylonian captivity. They were discouraged, and it's telling the story about how God is still in charge. Daniel is very similar to the book of Revelation. Of course, there's a lot of parallels there. But the book of Revelation is written to people who are going through persecution and all kinds of social and physical persecution because of the Roman Empire. Now, both books emphasize God's sovereignty. When we go through times, and it could be that our nation, especially in the next few decades, are going to be more like the people of Daniel and the people of the book of Revelation. We are going to be more pushed into the fringe of our culture. We're going to struggle more socially to be accepted as Christians. And we're probably maybe will have some forms of persecution. And many Christians are experiencing persecution throughout the world. It is at those times that the books of Daniel and Revelation will be more meaningful, because it is at the times where you are struggling in your culture and you're struggling with evil powers, evil rulers, and a lot of wickedness, and you feel like Christians are being oppressed, that you have to remember something. It's the old doctrine we call God's sovereignty. And that is, God is in charge, even though it may not look like it right now. God is in charge, even though it may not look like it right now. And that's what the book of Daniel teaches, is that God is in charge. He's in charge over the wisdom of men. He's in charge over the future. He's in charge over the trials we face. He's in charge over pride-filled leaders, even though He may be using them at the time. He's in charge over wicked nations. And He's in charge over His creation. We believe that and we accept that by faith. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, I want you to think about, He rules in all these ways, but does He rule in your heart? Does He rule in your heart? If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, come as together we stand.